introduce everyone to our presenter. So at this point, I'm going to ask my co-worker, Barbara Charis, who's helping, to change the layout. We'll call up Taylor's presentation materials. And I just wanted to introduce everyone to Taylor, who is a principal consultant with CulturePoint. He has experience as a facilitator and trainer and as a researcher. So in addition to working as a consultant with major DoD clients, Taylor also recently earned his doctorate in linguistics at the University of Pennsylvania. So he's presented papers at a variety of locations, including the Linguistics Society of America, the American Dialect Society, and the Penn Linguistics Conference. And his research has also been published in leading linguistics journals, and he's given talks at many establishments, including Stanford University, New York University, University of Texas, and the list goes on. So I just wanted to take a moment here again to welcome Taylor, thank him for coming back to deliver another session. And at this point, I will go ahead and turn things over to Taylor to start today's session.
All right, thank you. I'm assuming everybody can hear me. If you can't, please leave a note in the Q&A or the comment window. And just very quickly, as a point of order, I will tell everyone that I am doing this from something like a home office, and I will be managing the presentation with a little bit of moving back and forth. So I see things on a lag here. So if you leave a question or a comment and I don't get to it, I will expect our moderators likely to bring it to my attention. So that said, let's get started. And you should see course objectives here. So, Jane, can you confirm that I have actually moved to the course objectives?
You have.
Yeah. All right, perfect. All right. So that said, I'm going to assume that everybody can see what I'm going to throughout, and if not, somebody should, you know, speak up. So the course objectives today are to understand how people evaluate presentations, to review the best practices for presentations, and to develop a game plan for presentations. And this last one is something that you'll do, you know, on your own afterwards. But the idea here is to give you the tools where you understand how people evaluate presentations and what the best practices are, and then you can put that together as you're putting together presentations for whatever you're putting them together for. I know we're not all meeting in person anytime soon, but this should still be pretty ageless advice that'll be helpful for you in the future. So the agenda is four parts. I'm going to introduce myself and the topic. I'll give you an overview of the research and what that tells us about presentation skills. Then an overview of presentation skills themselves. This is sort of what to know and then what to do. And lastly, we'll put it all together. We'll have time for Q&A. As a couple of ground rules, what I'll say is if you have questions, please do not hesitate to write them or to share them. And I will be soliciting questions throughout. If, you know, something pops up and it's not during a time that I'm soliciting questions, please feel free to share it then. And, you know, we will make a point of getting to them. So that said, I'm going to go right into the introduction here. So I want to start with who I am, which is, you know, why you should listen to me in the first place when talking about presentations. And I recognize that you just had a quick introduction, but I want to give you a little bit more. So first, I'm a facilitator with decades of experience teaching difficult topics around diversity and inclusion. And that's relevant in part because when you talk about diversity, when you talk about inclusion, these are topics that can be very fraught with difficulty for people and fraught with emotion. So these are topics that it takes a certain amount of skill to navigate and make sure that you're not losing audience members or, you know, having audience members pick fights with one another or whatever else. So the idea here is that this background is managing people's discussions of contentious topics. That said, I'm also a quantitative social scientist with teaching experience across a variety of classes, over 50 conference talks, invited lectures, academic talks, talks for the general public. So I go back and forth between, you know, one, doing the research, but presenting research either to very specific, targeted, jargon-heavy, specialist audiences, and then presenting the same research in an accessible way to the general public or to undergraduate students or what have you. And that includes, you know, recently a number of interviews on NPR, NBC, wherever else. So the idea is that really I have a strong background in tailoring the message to the audience. And lastly, while it might seem less relevant, I have a background as a performer, specifically playing music professionally. And I think that actually really is relevant to giving presentations, even, you know, PowerPoint presentations for work, in part because it's something that gives you the skill to read a room. And I think that's important. And oftentimes we get caught up in the content of a presentation and don't have as much time or energy to focus on, you know, what's actually happening in the room as we're managing that presentation. And so one of the things I want to do is give everybody the skills to walk away from this with the ability to better manage a room, better manage the people, and know that your presentation itself is going to be solid and support you in doing that. So tying that all together, I would say that my career consists of communicating scientific ideas to the general public through presentations, relying on the platform skills that we're going to discuss shortly. So at this point, what I will do, I expect there probably aren't any questions. Normally I ask, what questions do you have? But at this point what I'll ask is, are there any questions before we move on?
No, just logistics questions about your slides, and I'll remind everyone the slides are available to access, and I'll be sharing those instructions throughout.
All right, perfect. So we're going to move into an overview of the research on presentation skills, and what I want to do is just make it clear why this matters. So we're starting with why bother. There is a wealth of research that indicates that platform skills affect perceived credibility. So what that means is the way that you give a presentation, not just the content of it, but the way in which you deliver that content, is going to affect whether people believe the content that you're sharing with them and whether they believe you as somebody who is credible and therefore believe the information that you're giving them. All of you, I believe, are public-facing. Your work is important, and it's important that you communicate effectively with people. So, you know, we do work with NARPA and we do work with OSC. You're dealing with some pretty complicated material that sometimes is negative or elicits negative emotions from people. And it's very important. It's important that they understand and that they be able to evaluate what it is that you're telling them and act on it in a reasonable way. So it's hugely important that you have these skills. The last part, and I think this is the most important, is that they're skills. They're not inherent. You can learn, you can practice, you can improve. So we have this sort of idea, usually, that some people are better at giving presentations than others, and it's because they're naturally charismatic or naturally can read a room. And for some people, that may be true, but these are all skills that anybody can learn, anybody can practice. It may take more practice for some of us than for others, but these are skills that everybody can develop, everybody can hone, and they can really, really improve your ability to give good presentations. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here. I'd just say, you know, too bad, so sad. Some of you just aren't going to give good presentations. And I think that's wrong. That's the wrong mindset to have. So there's a ton of research on this. Some of it better than others, you know, some of it more interesting than others. But the key points here, I'm going to give you a few highlights. I've given sort of chapter and verse here. I've given you the names of the authors and the date. You don't have to go and read this as homework. If you do, it's a whole rabbit hole that people can go down because you'll start reading all their references and all their references. But I've sort of handpicked a few key points to be aware of. So one main takeaway is that we can tell when people believe what they're saying and when they're confident in it. And there's a variety of different ways that we can tell that. So social psychologists and linguists have been interested in what are the cues to determine, you know, one, when somebody is trustworthy, but two, what are the cues that people are using, whether they're accurate or not, to evaluate whether somebody is trustworthy, whether they believe what they're saying, whether they're confident in it, whether we should believe it, all of this stuff. So one is verbal versus nonverbal skills. Tenney et al. Found that people really pay attention to nonverbal communication. And what that means is as you're talking, if you're fidgeting, if you're slouched, if you're sort of looking at your hands, if you're sort of glancing around, if you're giving off these physical signs of either discomfort or sheepishness or what have you, that other people pick up on that. And that we will evaluate the content of what you're saying, the actual linguistic content of what you're saying, in light of the body language as well. So I'm sure everybody's heard these sayings that, you know, 70% of communication is body language, or 90% of communication is body language, or 95 is. And I would caution you that those numbers are usually a little wild. They're a little exaggerated. But that's not to say that people don't evaluate body language at all. And Tenney et al. Finds, among other things, that people do pay attention to your body language as you're talking. So we'll talk about how to manage that effectively a little bit later on in the presentation, but this is something to remember is important. Another is the sounds of confidence and doubt. So Jiang and Pell found that we attend to people's voices, not just what you're saying, but again, how you're saying it. And in that case, there's a variety of different features that affect perceived credibility. One is speed, one is pitch, one is some more technical, phonetic, linguistic stuff like jitter and shimmer in the voice, which is, you know, how creaky your voice is, how breathless you sound, all of this stuff. Another study found that professionals lower their vocal frequency when giving expert advice. And I love this study because what they did is they took experts, they put them in a room, and they subjected them to a social psychology study where it's one of those classic studies where you don't know the study is happening because you think some other task is the actual study. So, you know, we're going to have you fill out a questionnaire later. But the real study is while you're waiting to fill out the questionnaire, they have somebody come in and ask you where the bathroom is. And what they found is that when experts are giving expert advice, they speak lower in their vocal register. This doesn't mean they just drop their voice completely, but it's just they speak in a comfortable lower part of their register. When they don't know what they're talking about, one of the ways that we communicate that we don't know what we're talking about is raising our voice. So people would say, can you tell me where the bathroom is? And they'd say, I think it's down the hall and maybe to the left, and I think I saw it. Something like that, where the voice is much higher in their comfortable register. And so this is something that people attend to as well. And I'm sure some of you have seen presentations where somebody's uncomfortable, just uncomfortable giving a presentation, but they express that in part by raising their voice and communicating that discomfort. And one of the things that does is has the effect of communicating a lack of confidence in what you're saying. And you can be the most confident person in the world. You can know that what you're saying is correct, but if you're not confident while you're giving a presentation, it can start to give the wrong signals. And again, these are skills that can be practiced. So whether you're feeling confident is one thing. Whether you're displaying confidence is another. So part of that is that the cues to confidence are measurable. I mentioned pitch, intonation, and speed influence perceptions of speaker confidence. There's a study from 2019 that talks about that. Pitch is that, you know, how high or low your voice is in your natural register. So there's a movie that came out a while back on HBO. It's a documentary called The Inventor. And one of the criticisms of this woman who the documentary is about is that she consistently tried to pitch her voice lower than was natural for her. And it was distracting for people and made them sort of think that she had something sort of duplicitous going on, which the documentary elaborates on. So the idea here is pitch should be something that's comfortable for you, that's natural within your speaking range, and that we use pitch communicatively to do all sorts of things, including ask questions. So we'll talk a little bit more about that later, but pitch is one of those things that it's worth paying attention to. Where am I talking? And I know a lot of people have, for instance, a phone voice. A lot of my, you know, female friends and colleagues will start presentations with their phone voice, which is about an octave higher than their presentation voice, which they settle into slowly. This is something just to be aware of. Intonation is that rise and fall of the voice as you're modulating pitch. And then speed. For me, I come from a background where we talk fast, and I live in New York. Everybody talks fast. It's something that I have to be aware of as I'm talking, but speed affects people's perceptions of your confidence. If you're speaking too fast, people start to wonder why you're speaking so fast. If you're speaking too slowly, people start to wonder why you're dragging things on. And again, this is within a normal range, so I expect that everybody here is, you know, if you think about how you speak normally, that's not going to be too fast or too slow. It's a question of what you do when you start becoming aware of how you're speaking in front of a room of people. So we can talk about how to address those a little bit later when I talk about what to do. But the point here is that these are things that people notice. These are specific things that we can say people notice this, 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 and this. and here's how we can address those things. And then the last one on this slide is that we're more likely to believe and cooperate with people who send signals of confidence. And the really interesting study that Clark did in 2008 was even when we later think it wasn't about presentation skills. So they did this matched guys study where they had people give the same presentation, but they had these cues of confidence, and some of it was body language or whatever. I don't remember exactly what they did in the study. But what they found was that people evaluated the same presentation differently depending on the apparent confidence of the person giving that presentation. So they said, oh yeah, I believe that more. So this is something that tells us that there's something to this. The research is telling us that presentation skills matter. But more importantly, not only can we measure that, because we can measure it, we can improve with training. And there's a study for that as well. So Siebold and Rood, which is one of the best names for doing this, found that communication training improves presentation skills, which is to say that a presentation like the one that I'm doing right now, combined with practice, can improve your presentation skills. And we know that improved presentation skills means that people are more likely to believe what you're saying, people are more likely to have confidence in what you're saying, they're more likely to go along with what you're saying, and they're more likely to enact whatever, you know, needs to be enacted if you're NARPM or OSC or, you know, somebody who needs the general public to actually do something based on what you're telling them. So the takeaway here is that presentation skills matter. Presentation skills and confidence affect believability, audience confidence. The better your presentation skills, the easier your presentation will go. And I mean that not just the more people believe you, but the easier it will be for you. We can improve communication skills with training and practice. And again, you have an important message. So that is the overview of the research. What I will do next is move into an overview of presentation skills, but I want to pause here and ask, what questions do you have?
And so at this point, I don't see any questions in the queue, but I will wait just a moment in case someone was getting ready to type something in. So remember, your questions and comments for Taylor will come into that Q&A window in the lower right corner. If you have no questions for Taylor, type in no questions in the Q&A window so Taylor can be confident that he can move on and that you all are ready to carry on. So either enter no questions or start to enter them. And I am now seeing some things pop into this queue. So I'll start with this question.
Sure.
One of our participants noted that given the current and potential future limitations to provide presentations in person, we have recently been moving to presenting online and using a variety of meeting platforms. How do you feel that this is going to affect how people communicate during presentations as a whole?
I suspected we'd be talking about this today. there are a couple of key differences, which we'll talk about when we get to things like body language and testing out the technology, but I think the general principles will carry over. There's a couple of things as well that sort of neither here nor there, but I think are interesting. So one of the things that I've noticed as people have moved over to, you know, Adobe and to Zoom and to Skype and to FaceTime and all these other things is that, and we'll come back to this when we talk about body language and technology, but the quick little point is where you're looking, and little things like, you know, having your thumb covering the camera if you're holding it on an iPad or something like that. So what your camera setup is and then what your audio setup is really affect your perceived credibility or technological capability in that case. And I've made a note for myself that when we talk about body language, I was going to add some of these things. But the preview of that is making sure that your camera setup is a reasonable angle and testing that out in advance. Making sure that your background is reasonable and testing that out in advance. And then if you want to go really above and beyond, having high-quality audio. And so I have been experimenting with, I'm currently using just a home phone right now. For other meetings, I have a $12 lapel mic that I got on Amazon, and the audio quality is so much infinitely better than the built-in microphone on my laptop. So these are things to think about. I'm not saying everybody needs to go out and buy, you know, specialized camera gear and microphones and whatever else, but I think it depends on who you're presenting to and what the context is. And we can talk a lot more about that in the next section. Are there any other questions that I have?
Actually, okay. Lots starting to come in, but
right. I think I suspect a lot of these I'll say we'll get to that, but some of them I'm sure we may want to hit right now.
Yeah, so there were some questions about intonation. And so one of your participants wanted to know if you could sort of clarify, how does intonation affect perception of a presenter? Is more or less intonation better?
Oh, that's interesting. So there's a lot of linguistic research on intonation, and I think some of it is stuff that we're all consciously aware of. Some of it is stuff that we're not consciously aware of, but we do attend to, and some of it seems to have an effect on people whether we're aware of it or not. And what I'll go through those one at a time. So the one that people are consciously aware of is what linguists refer to as high-rising terminal and what pretty much everybody else refers to as uptalk. It is similar to list intonation, where if I'm saying a list of items, my pitch rises at the end of each item, and it tells you that I'm going to continue talking. A larger and larger number of people, especially Americans, but also, you know, this happens everywhere in the English-speaking world, will use high-rising terminal to indicate that they are not done talking. And often it's somewhere between I'm not finished and I'm soliciting that you are still listening. So it has this sort of question quality to it, but not quite. People who really, really dislike it, and there are a number of people who have very strong feelings about it, dislike it because they say it sounds like you're unsure of yourself and you're asking me rather than telling me. These, every year this is an older and older age bracket of people, because it's something that's spreading really dramatically in the English-speaking world. But that's one thing to be aware of, that some people are going to be people who have very strong feelings about high-rising terminal. And similarly, you know, if you have verbal tics that use that, so if I were to say, people are going to feel really strongly about high-rising terminal, right? And then continue, right? And keep asking you, you know, for back channel confirmation. Those are things that people react to in presentations. And in part, it's because I think they expect a different kind of communication in presentations. And what they get is normal conversational talk. And they react much more strongly to high-rising terminal in that context. There's also differences in intonation as far as both dialect and what linguists refer to as ethnolect, which is linguistic styles that are associated with different ethnicities. So there's a ton of work on like Yiddish English, on African American English, on Appalachian English, and there's different intonational patterns that people recognize as being related to those. A really well-known example within linguistics would be that both Yiddish English and African American English have much higher pitch range peaks in focused material, so that people will use, you know, falsetto at certain times. But that's a whole rabbit hole to get into. What I would say is just being aware of intonational contours that people use and think about what you would use conversationally with friends and then maybe step back a little bit from there and think about what you hear on, I don't know, the news, like, you know, and not opinion news shows, but, you know, any sort of nightly news broadcast. Doesn't matter the presenter's background, you'll notice that they're using a very sort of standard range of intonational contours. And I hope that answers the question.
Yeah,
well,
I think that does.
Revisit it if not. All right, so I think that's a good segue.
I think it's a great time to move on, but I know that there are a lot of questions in the queue. You're not lost. We're really going to move on, and we'll circle back to many of these later on.
Okay, and if people have the same questions, feel free to add those, and I'm sure you can what's the word I'm looking for? You can curate them for me. All right, so I have divided this section into four subsections. We're going to talk about the presentation skills. This is your overview of presentation skills. And the competencies can be divided into these four sections: content management, visual aids, platform skills, which is your physical, you know, presentation, and participant management. So visual aids and platform skills are going to be these sort of, you know, web-based platforms where that comes in. And then participant management is dealing with people who, you know, just dealing with people, really, positive or negative in your presentations. But first, we turn to content management. So effective speakers will connect the subject matter with the objectives, analyze participants' needs, current level of expertise and expectations, identify and organize the key points that support the objectives and meet participant needs, and identify potential problem areas and strategies. And you'll notice I started with connect subject matter with objectives. Does anybody remember what the first slide was? It was, and this is me asking a room full of, you know, people who are completely separated by distance and muted, so I will tell you, it was me giving you the course objectives. I said we are going to do this, this, and this. And I gave you an agenda. Here's how we're going to do that and what order we're going to do them. So you can absolutely explicitly connect the subject matter with objectives, and in fact, I highly, highly recommend it. Think about why am I here, why am I talking, what is the goal of this talk, and then implicitly or explicitly connect the subject matter with what those objectives are. What you'll have to do in order to do that is to analyze your participants' needs, current level of expertise, and their expectations, and that can vary wildly. So I think a lot of you give talks to the general public where you can expect that they probably don't know specific scientific jargon. They may not have a high level of expertise, although every now and then you get that one ringer who has read everything there is to know about the one topic that you're presenting on, and they really want to talk to you about it. And we'll talk about participant management as well, and then what their expectations are for the talk. And so, you know, for instance, I give talks to the general public and I give talks to academic conferences, and those are going to be very, very different talks, even on the same subject matter. So there's one example that I like to give, which is work that I've done on the morphosyntax of Zulu, which is a Bantu language spoken in South Africa. Right there, what I've done out of habit, really, is when I am talking to the general public, I'll say, I'm talking about Zulu, which is a language in this family, which is spoken here. And in a linguistics conference, I can just leave it at Zulu and start talking about sub, you know, varieties of it. But the idea is that you're going to think about who's going to be in the audience and what can I reasonably expect them to know. And even then, if you reasonably expect people to know, you know, a certain amount of material, it's still worthwhile to very briefly elaborate on any sort of jargon, any sort of point where people might be confused. Now, as you're putting together your content, what you'll do is identify and organize key points that support the objectives and meet the participants' needs once you have those objectives and participant needs identified. And that may be a slightly different presentation than you originally wanted to give. So the key here is you have this goal. You have what are the objectives, you have what are participants' needs, and you can start to say, okay, how do I get to those objectives and meet those participant needs with what I have, and then cut the rest. And that's I think, painful for a lot of us if we're researchers, if we want to give people a very complete picture. But depending on how much time you have, depending on the audience, you really want to make sure that your talk is meeting those objectives and meeting their needs and not just filling in all the information there is to know about this subject, which is often how a lot of us start with presentations. I know a lot about this. I'm going to tell you everything about it. That's not usually very helpful. And the last part is you want to identify problem areas and strategies. So where can people go astray? And that's hugely important, and I think that's a part that people really don't spend a lot of time on. I think a lot of us panic about, you know, what if it goes poorly? What if they don't like me? What if they're bored? What if they're angry? What if I get, you know, run out of town with pitchforks and torches? But we're not thinking about what are the exact problem areas in the talk that might lead to that outcome, right? What are the words that people will be confused by? Where am I not particularly clear in my organization so it doesn't make sense how I got from one thing to the next? And if you can identify those, you go a long way towards making the talk much, much more effective and much lower stakes. You know you're not going to offend people. You know you're not going to confuse people. Or you're ready, if they are confused, to answer those questions. So building on that, you'll start with what is the key point of your talk? Why are you here? I really love thinking about this in terms of Twitter. Historically, you'd say, what is the elevator pitch, right? What is the 30-second version of it that you can give to somebody as you're riding an elevator together? First of all, nobody's riding elevators together anymore, and we don't know when they will be. But second of all, I really like the 280-character version. What's the tweet version of your talk? And if you haven't seen it, this is a complete tangent, but I highly recommend Tweet My Thesis, which is a challenge for people to take their dissertations and their theses and put them in the shortest, most concise, easiest possible terms. And it is hilarious and delightful. So once you have your key point, once you have your tweet version or your elevator pitch, then what you have to do is backfill. You say, what do people need to know to understand that point? And that's not necessarily going to be everything that needs to be said about that topic. And one of the things that I've found over the years is really, really helpful is you can say certain key things, certain key foundational points. If they're going to take you down a rabbit hole, you can say, you know, you just declare it. You can say, this is the case for these reasons, these are citations, ask me about it after the talk, but I'm building on this, and move on. But what you do is you take the key points that people need to know to understand the point of your talk, and you want to line them up in a way that people can actually follow along and understand. You leave the breadcrumbs for them. And this last piece is, where can they go astray? And that is hugely, hugely, hugely important. That's that part that people often overlook. And I think if you have an idea of where people can go astray and you have a couple of quick answers for it, then you should be good. And this should be just, what are the reasonable things that are difficult for people to understand here? Every now and then you're going to have a participant in a presentation where they've just completely missed the point, or they completely misunderstood what you were saying, or they want to talk about something else altogether, and that can't really be helped with this kind of preparation, specifically with content management. But for the most part, people who are participating in good faith and listening to what you have to say and really trying to understand, they're going to be doing their best, but sometimes people tune out, sometimes people misunderstand a word or think that they understood it and really they're thinking something else. And the more that you can say what are the problem areas where people can go astray and be prepared for that, the easier it is. And then when they ask you these questions at the end, the questions are predictable and you have a solid answer for, you know, whatever their question is. So in order to do that, we're going to talk about your basic organization in a little bit more fine-grained detail. What I would recommend is you introduce the topic, provide a motivation, describe the necessary context, explain the research question or point you want to make, and then lay out the data and analysis strategy or lay out the argument that you're going to make. And you'll notice after the objectives, this gets very meta as we continue, but after the objectives and the agenda, I gave you an introduction to the topic, I provided a motivation. In this case, the motivation is that what you have to say is very important and that presentation skills matter. I described the necessary context, which is, again, you know, very similar. You're giving presentations, what you have to say matters, the way that presentations are given affects believability, et cetera, et cetera. And then explain the research question or point you want to make, often with a research background. So I, again, started with what is the research on this topic and what does it tell us about this topic before laying out the analysis of the argumentation strategy. So in this case, the argument is we can divide this into what to know and what to do, and we're going to go through with what to know and what to do as you go through it. So that's the basic organization. Should all see basic organization continued here. So what you'll do then is document your findings or document your argument point by point or laying out just the necessary pieces to make your argument. Then provide comments to explain your findings, the implications of the argument, you know, what did I say, and wrap up. And I highly recommend what we usually call signposting every step of the way. So as you have segues from one part of the presentation to the next, and this goes the same for anything from a 10-minute presentation to a, you know, full week of 8-hour-a-day training, you should have signposts where you say, we did this, we're going to do this. You tie a pretty bow on everything that you've just done. So with a basic organization, for instance, you know, you can lay things out point by point. You can make just the necessary arguments. But when you're done, you say, here's a quick summary of what I just said, effectively. And then you can wrap that up and, you know, have time for questions. At this point, I want to ask you, what questions do you have about content management before we move on to visual aids?
All right. So there are a number of questions that have come in, but a lot of them are focusing more on the visual components in an online meeting. in terms of if you add visuals of the presenter, would that be distracting from the visuals that you're putting out there in your slide content? So there's a lot of questions about, you know, the online environment and some things that they should do there, not necessarily in the content arrangement.
So I think that's a good thing. I have a section on visual aids, but this is primarily on building slides, and I think this would be a perfect time to and a perfect transition to that. So let's just answer those questions.
Okay. So one of the attendees wanted to know, when you're doing online trainings, do you recommend that the presenters show themselves or just show their slides?
I have mixed feelings about that, as you can tell by the fact that you're looking at a picture of me but not a video of me. So I think it really depends on the presentation and it really depends on the presenter. Obviously, the main focus of your presentation should be your presentation. So I think, personally, I don't have any problem with not having the presenter visible at all. That said, I understand there's something to be said for people having an idea of who's talking to them, and you know, as you're managing a presentation visually, if you have the visual capability, if you have the bandwidth, if you have an appropriate background and appropriate clothing and all of that, and appropriate lighting, then, and you feel like it would give benefit in some way, you know, that you can better connect with people or better communicate with people, then I say go for it. But the flip side of that is I don't think it's necessary. And what I'll say is, so we've done this webinar, was it 6 times in the last year? Something like that? Okay. And then, as well, given this same talk live about as many times. And this is the first that people, because of COVID-19 and this mass migration to Skype and FaceTime and Zoom and all of that, this is the first that people have been asking about seeing the presenter. So every previous version of this webinar, we have my face up, give a little webinar talk. You have my slides to focus on and the Q&A. And there has been much discussion of that. But because there's been this migration to virtual meeting spaces, there's now a blurring of lines between a presentation and a meeting and whatever else. So, for instance, I mentioned that I defended my dissertation recently. I did that via Zoom, which was not ideal, but it's something that's the direction that things have been going. When I did that with Zoom, I was visible to the audience. The audience was visible to me as well, although in smaller screens, and my presentation was the main slide. And I strongly recommend, if the more you can have the focus on the presentation, the better that is. Unless you feel that there's some really important reason that you should be visible and that adds to the presentation as well. So I hope that answers that. Part of me wants to say, don't be bullied into turning your video on if you don't want to. But the other part of that is, if it will benefit your presentation, then go for it. I think there's this sort of mass migration to virtual meetings, and I think it's better for a virtual meeting and worse for an actual presentation.
Okay. And you're actually segueing right to the next question, commenting that it's body language, not just your own, but also your participants that you might read if you were giving a presentation. And so others have asked how you might read a room like that over a webinar platform if you're not physically looking at your audience.
So it's the same, honestly. It's a little weird because the angles are all wrong. You're looking up at people a lot of times. But what I will say is the same thing that I will reiterate later when we talk about managing a room in person. You can't necessarily read too much into an audience's body language. And by that I mean, as you're talking to a physical room with people in it, you will have people who are very interested in what you're saying, but look like they're not. And I always tell this one story. So I gave a talk at the Naval Postgraduate School to the Navy Senior Leaders Seminar, and there was a captain who was in the front row, former fighter pilot, Navy captain, really, really interesting guy, and he looked like he was fast asleep and just seemed very bored. And I thought, oh my God, I'm tanking. I'm like, this presentation is going awful. I'm boring this man. This is the worst. You know, I was spinning out in my mind in the front of the room. After the talk, he said, "That was great. I hope I didn't bother you by closing my eyes, but I find that I can listen better that way. Here's my business card. I'd like to invite you to our command to come talk as well." So I would caution, don't read too much into it. And, you know, in over a decade of doing facilitation in the room in person, there's going to be a lot of different reasons that people are going to have a lot of different expressions on their face, and it's not necessarily always what we think at the front of the room that is communicating. So they may be, you know, thinking about something else. They may be, you know, dyspeptic from lunch. They may be a variety of different things, and it's very easy to overinterpret that. And I think when you have a Zoom meeting or a Skype meeting or a FaceTime or an Adobe Connect or whatever else, it creates that audience feeling, even within the context of one of these meetings. And what I mean is, if you were at a table having a conversation at a round table with everybody face to face, there's a particular way that we would participate in something like that. Whereas if you are, you know, all members of an audience, people feel much more inclined to physically give off the vibe that they're zoning out a little bit. And I've seen that with virtual meetings in particular. People act more like they're audience members than participants, in part because, you know, it's very, very similar to what we do as audience members, watching television, watching, you know, Netflix or whatever. So it sort of triggers that kind of behavior. I would say that one of the things that you can do is focus on being a good audience member when you are, you know, in these virtual meetings. But the body language is in some ways very similar to giving a presentation, but it's similar to giving a different kind of presentation than you might think, which is, you know, a large presentation with an audience where you're at a lectern and they're all just there as an audience. I think people are doing a little bit less of the kind of audience management and back channel, you know, reinforcement, like positive reinforcement of what you're saying, than we normally do in a face-to-face meeting. I think that was a great question, and I hope I answered it for you.
I think you did.
Is there anything else before we move on to visual aids?
No, I think we'll go ahead and carry on with the session, but keep those questions and comments coming in, and we'll pause again.
Yeah, this has so far been the most interesting session because of this dramatic change. We're doing just radically different questions. All right, so I'm moving on to visual aids. And right now I'm going to talk specifically about just PowerPoint, basically, or whatever slideshows you use. So effective speakers prepare visuals that are legible or readable. And that goes as well for if you're writing on a whiteboard or a flip chart or something like that. You want to make sure that if you're writing by hand, that it's readable, that it's large enough. On slides, it should be clearly related to the content being presented. It should be organized and consistently formatted. When I say related to the content being presented, that's huge. And I mean, I love using visuals. I think having an image that people can have as sort of a mental hook is fantastic. But it should be related. And when I say that, I keep thinking of a particular presentation that I saw in 2015 at a linguistics conference where I honestly could not tell you what the presentation was about, but everybody remembers that talk as the one with the cats because this person gave a talk where every single slide had cat memes from the internet. And I am very sort of liberal in that regard. I think maybe, you know, a judiciously used cat meme from the internet could even be a good thing. But this was every single slide, and I could not tell you, and I don't know anybody who can, I couldn't tell you what the actual presentation was about because all I remember and all anybody else remembers is it was absurd how much, you know, how many cat meme images there were from the internet on this slide. I think it was about phonology, but beyond that, I couldn't really say. So you want it to be clearly related to the content being presented, and you want to strike the appropriate professional tone. I think I'll talk a little bit about humor later, but I'd say be very sparing and judicious. Make sure that you know it's going to land, and this ties directly to that. But a visual is sometimes very helpful. The visuals should be organized, so you'll notice my slides follow a consistent formatting, and they should be organized in a way where it's easy for people to follow where you are in the presentation and to know, you know, even if they zone out for a minute, they come back, they look at the slide, they go, ah, we're talking about this. And lastly, consistently formatted. I think there's a typo hidden in one of these slides, but in general, you should see that everything is the same font. Everything is consistently sized. The bullets are all the same sizes and shapes and colors for the presentation. And people will notice and will strongly, strongly care about little things that you wouldn't think they would notice. So if your slide goes back and forth between Times New Roman and Calibri and Helvetica and, you know, Comic Sans and Papyrus and whatever else, people will notice immediately that you're all over the place with the fonts. People will notice immediately if there's stray commas or periods or extra spaces. And it's the kind of thing that as you're putting together a presentation, it's very difficult to catch them as you've seen this same presentation over and over and over again. But it will make a difference to the audience, and they will notice, especially if the formatting is inconsistent. Now, there's a couple of ways that you should manage visual aids. One is testing equipment and having contingency plans. I talk a little bit more about this when I talk about technology, but especially given Zoom and given Skype and all of that stuff, testing equipment is even more important now. And again, having contingency plans. So, for instance, with the coronavirus, I am not giving this presentation from the original location that I was going to be, which is 40 Wall Street. I am instead in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. And so what that meant is prior preparation, where I know that I had the slides to everybody in advance. I know that I have my internet set up, so I'm hardwired into an internet provider right now rather than relying on Wi-Fi. I'm on a home phone, but I have a backup home phone charging. I have a emergency plan in case one of those rings. So hopefully you don't hear me have to enact that emergency plan. But these are things to think about as you're going through. And then, of course, as you're doing it in person, which we should all hope to get back to, then you'll want to know, is there a slide projector in the room that you're going to be in if you have slides? Is it set up? Does it talk to your computer? Do you need to provide your slides to somebody else, or do you bring yours? If you bring yours, do you have the hardware to connect it or to somebody else? These are, you know, basic ideas where the more you have this taken care of, the less you have to worry about day of. And the earlier you arrive to check it out, the more time you have to just be centered and calm and prepared for your talk. As you're giving a talk, you'll want to position the body to avoid blocking participants' views. This is one thing that virtual meetings have made easy. It's very hard for you to stand in front of your slides at this point. But in general, as you're giving talks, back in the world again, you want to make sure that you're not blocking participants' views. And what that means is figuring out where people are in the room, because it can be easy to think that, okay, I'm standing to the side of my slides, everybody should be able to see, but you end up blocking one side of the room or another, depending on what the lines of sight are. So that's something to, you know, put yourself in the audience shoes. If you arrive early, or rather, when you arrive early, look at the layout of the room and figure out, where can I stand? If I were sitting here, what would I see? And then last, you want to talk to the participants rather than the visual. This is harder with virtual meetings because you end up looking at yourself, or if you're looking at the participants, you end up looking in a weird direction, and it can be very weird to train yourself to stare at the camera, but that, you know, can help. In the real world, though, a lot of what people do is look either at their notes or at their hands or at their feet and not at the participants, and this goes right back to that body language and communicating confidence or doubt. So there's a joke that I heard about engineers, but this is doubly true of linguists, and so I use it for linguists, and that is, how can you tell the outgoing linguist? And the answer is, they're the one staring at your shoes instead of their own when they're talking to you. I will pause for laughter and applause. All right, so I want to move on from there and talk about what makes a slide bad, as we're talking about visual aids. So when you have good slides, it can be easy to take them for granted. In this case, there's a specific slide format that I'm expected to use that I believe you're all expected to use and can ask for more information about that afterwards. But there's a specific format. If there's not a specific format, people sometimes go all over the place. So I'm going to show you some bad slides, and I will solicit answers as to what makes a slide bad. So here is one bad slide, and I want you to tell me why is this bad? But I also want you to notice that I am following the formatting for the rest of the slideshow, where I actually have my header, title, and then I have an image in my slide of a bad slide. So this is a bad slide, good slide. That said, what makes this bad?
Okay, so I will remind the audience that there's a new window that's popped up in the lower left that asks what makes this a bad slide, and you can type your answer in at the space at the top of that window. You can also scroll through the window to see what others are putting in. If you've already put an answer into the Q&A window, that is okay.
Yeah, I'm seeing a lot here.
Focusing on text and words. Words and text.
Can't read, too wordy, too much text. And some of you are starting to hit on why it's wrong. So, yes, there's a lot of text. Yes, it's hard to read. It's hard to read in part because there's a lot of text, but also, you know, some of you have pointed out this is a white font on a yellow, blue, and white background. It is unnecessarily small and is a serif font, which is, in this context, a little bit harder to read. In this case, it's also a JPEG image, which means that there's a little bit of pixelation as it was sort of downsampled. But then also, there's a lot going on here. So this does follow some of the principles that, you know, we'll talk about. In this case, there's, five bullet points. The problem is these bullet points are basically full paragraphs. And so you have something saying, you know, rivers start as very small streams and gradually get bigger. You have adverbs, you have adjectives that are completely unnecessary here. And it's telling the whole talk right here. So I once attended a keynote from a linguist. This was actually the last meeting of the Linguistic Society of America. And it was a historical linguist who had effectively written a paper for publication that it would take about an hour and a half to read aloud. And he just chopped it into slides and read it aloud, even though he was only allotted 1 hour. So that is an extreme example, but the idea here is as you're building slides, for instance, one of the things to focus on is what can I put on here as a hook for people to know where we are, to know what we're talking about, maybe to remind me what I was going to say, but where I'm not putting everything that I need to say directly onto the slide. Because what's going to happen is people will look at that and they will say, I am not reading all that, and then they will tune out. So the idea here is you want a simple hook that works as a mnemonic for you and a guide for everybody else, but they should be, you know, actually having to listen to what you're saying in order to you know, follow along with the talk. Here's another one for you. This is a Pentagon slide. The Pentagon is notorious for bad slides, and I would love to know your thoughts on this. I'm trying to refresh here, so I'm seeing illegible would make me tune out, too busy, looks like a plate of spaghetti. and I like the OMG as the response here. So yeah, this is ostensibly a analysis of, you know, the military situation in, I believe, in Iraq and Afghanistan. But the problem is this is an entire slideshow's worth of material that has been put. I'm sure that the person who put this together believes that they understand the organization, but it is not clear to anybody else reading this, and this should be easily an hour-long slideshow rather than a map where everything points to everything else. So the colors aren't clearly explained. The directionality doesn't make any sense. Obviously, it's too small here as well, but that's not to say that this would make, you know, a good poster, for instance, because it still would be a very bad poster. These are examples of bad slides. What I will say as I move on to the next slide, which is the other technology slide, is you have specific consistent formatting here. The EPA has specific formatting guidelines, and I believe you have access to model slide decks or can get access to model slide decks where you can then build off of those. And that solves a lot of problems for people. Even if you don't like the exact formatting of the model slide deck, if somebody has it for you, it is offered, make use of it, because it's less work for you, and it's usually, whether you agree with the specifics of it or not, it's usually much better than having to, you know, figure it out on your own. Some good key points would be having your slides numbered, having no more than 6 or 7 bullet points per slide, having no more than one sub-bullet point level for your slides, and not trying to write full paragraphs of text on the slides, but rather have something that you can build on as you're talking. And then, you know, what that does mean is you'll have to know what it is you want to say and be able to remember it from just seeing something on the slide rather than having the whole presentation written out for you where you don't practice it. What questions do you have about slides before we move on to other technology, which I think is going to be a particularly fruitful discussion today?
So there have been a number of comments where people were just simply indicating about Bluetooth earbuds, and that they could use that as an easy technology to use if they were doing a virtual presentation. So I don't know if you have any comments about the use of earbuds as an audio source when remotely speaking.
Yeah, that can work. So what I would definitely recommend for remote audio is making sure that you have, you want to think about feedback. So what that means is, depending on the technology platform that you're using, they may be better or worse at canceling out the feedback from your own speakers. As it plays audio from your speakers, it then is recording from your microphone, and some are better, some are worse at actually canceling that out. When you have something like earbuds with a built-in microphone, those can be really, really effective. One, any kind of earbuds or headphones will eliminate the issue with the microphone of having, you know, feedback loop. But two, a lot of them have really high quality microphones at this point. So, I have a set of noise canceling earbuds that have a built-in microphone, and the sound quality is fantastic. It rivals a lapel mic. That said, I'm reluctant to give people a specific thing and say go out and buy this particular headset because, who am I to spend your money for you on those, particular solutions. But yeah, that's an excellent starting point for sure. Just thinking about, having a headset, having your audio, not just the built-in audio and microphone on whatever your computer is.
Okay. I also have a few people asking real specific questions about graphics and text and how much can you do on one slide. So I'm kind of weaving multiple questions here into one general request about adding graphics. Is it a good idea? How do you balance that with the text that you might put on the slide?
Yeah, perfect. So one of the things that I would say to notice about that river slide before is that they put the text directly on top of the image, and it was unreadable, and the image is less clear as well. If you're going to incorporate an image, I strongly recommend side-by-side, where you have text on one side, image on the other. Just one image, right? So, if you Google Pentagon slides, one of the things you'll see is people just putting in 25 photographs into a PowerPoint slide. I would say keep it to one per slide. I caution against having them every slide as well, but it's really up to you. I think images can be very, very useful and very powerful and help people remember and understand what they're looking at. So, we recently did some work with the OSC folks and did some, one-on-one critiques of presentations. And some of the better presentations had images on half or most of the slides even, but they were directly related to what was being talked about, and it helped me follow along with the presentation. The other thing that I'll say, keeping in mind, as you're using images or choosing whether or not to use images, is you can't fit the same amount of text if you're using an image. So if I say, put 6 bullet points maximum and no more than one sub-bullet point, if you try and have half a slide with an image and then the other half with 6 bullet points, each with 1 or 2 sub-bullet points, it quickly becomes unreadable. So increasingly, especially as you're adding images, I would say think about, can I break this into 2 slides? Is it more readable? And you can even have the same image on two, one slide and the subsequent slide, but with different text as the image is related to what you're saying. The particular case that I'm thinking of was like a description of a specific site, and the on-site coordinator was talking about what the issues were with that site, and so it was like, this is the, this is the map of the site. And three of the slides had a map of the site. So as they're talking about this street and that street and the other, you can see where they are on the map, and it makes sense. And the next part was, this is where I think it was arsenic was in the ground. And so it was very clearly related to what was being talked about, but it helped follow along. And that's the key point as you're putting these together, is you want to say, what's going to help people understand what I'm saying? What's going to help people understand where we are in the presentation? And what can really add to what I'm talking about here? It should not just be, clip art and stock images and stock photos just for the sake of that. And there are some people who kind of go far in that direction, and I would caution against that. So I guess my answer is use images judiciously. They can add something very positive for a presentation, but then you with the amount of text you have, for instance. So you can't fit the same amount of text if you're adding images. And definitely don't put your text on top of the images. Is that good?
It does. Well, there's one other question that I did want to bring up. Multiple people have been asking about these very complex diagrams or charts, very similar to the bad examples that you were giving, particularly that DoD one, and asking for best practices in terms of how do they handle sharing that when that's the real visual. So do you have any suggestions when they
suggest zooming.
Complex chart?
Yeah, split it up. You can show everybody the full chart and then immediately break it apart and zoom into subsections that you're going to be focusing on. And I actually did that for my dissertation defense. I have a, without getting too far into it, I have a hierarchical, a agglomerative hierarchical cluster analysis with 181 nodes. It is unreadable when you look at the whole thing. It's color-coded by, the argument that I make is that it should be divided into 10 main areas. And so I showed them the whole tree color-coded with those 10 areas, which is unreadable. And I said, I recognize this is unreadable, but this is the whole thing. These are the 10 areas, and we're going to look at them one by one. And then the next slide is one of those sub-areas with its own slide that's readable as is. And I had just the image on the slide and verbally said what I needed to say about it, and then, in this case, drew on the slide as well. But what I would strongly, strongly recommend is if you have something like that and that is what you are tasked with communicating, show everybody, but then don't make just the whole thing, fit onto a tiny slide the only thing that you give them. Break it apart. Help people digest it piece by piece. Really, you want to spoon feed it to them. Are there any other questions?
I think at this point, let's go ahead and carry on.
All right, let's keep it moving.
We'll pause later for more questions. Yeah.
Perfect. All right, so for other technology, if you are going somewhere in person, arrive early and find your point of contact for tech. And I will say I recognize that the way things have been with, social isolation lately, it feels like we're never going anywhere again. But I guarantee this will all be relevant to you sooner than you expect. So as you're going someplace, make sure you leave extra time. Arrive early, find your point of contact for tech, if there is one, hope that there is one, and then test the microphone setup if it's present. If it is present, don't assume that everyone can hear you, because there's a variety of reasons why people might not be able to, and they're not necessarily always going to tell you that. So, for instance, I had a fear for a moment that my phone was dying talking about technology here, so I have my backup ready, but I think I'm good. So, as I was saying, test the microphone setup, and don't assume that people can hear you. A lot of us fall back on this, can everybody hear me? I'll just talk louder. And that's a bad habit for a variety of reasons. So I have a lot of military clients where people have invisible disabilities, oftentimes hearing loss. They will not necessarily tell you that they have hearing loss. They will just sit there and hope that they can hear. And an extreme example of this was a linguistics conference that I was at recently where there was a talk about different varieties of sign language. Half the room was either deaf or hard of hearing. And there was somebody who refused a microphone. And she said, I'll just talk louder. I hope you can all hear me in the back, which was totally just bananas. And the other issue there is that the sign language interpreters then could not hear her to interpret for the people who needed it, which was about half the room in this case. So it's an extreme example, but the point that I'm trying to make is if there is a microphone available to you, use it. If there are people who are hard of hearing, it will help them. There are sometimes people who are directly connected to the AV system in the room with auditory implants or whatever else. And so just anything that you can do to make it easier on people, you should do. And I'll say as well, one of the things that I've been doing is trying to make slides colorblind friendly. These slides are not because the colors were not up to me. To the extent that you have control over it and it's something that you can do, I would strongly recommend doing that. The idea here is with whatever technology you have, you want to make sure that it works, that you know how it works, that you're not finding out at the beginning of a talk that your slides don't work. And if there's anything that makes other people's lives easier, just use it. And I know a lot of us hate the sound of our voice. So this is where I tell you that that is completely normal and natural, and you should still use the microphone. The reason that we hate the sound of our voice is because if we all are used to hearing our own voice, not the way that other people hear it, which is just sound waves in the world, but hearing it with that combined with the resonance in our chest and our throat and our actual skull vibrating with our own speech. So when we hear our own selves recorded, it doesn't sound like what we're used to hearing, and it can be very sort of disconcerting and weird. What I would say is be aware of that, recognize that that is normal and natural, and to the extent that you're using a microphone can really help other people, just, get over it. That said, I want to ask if there are other questions about technology before we move on to the basics of platform skills for in-person.
So not too many specific technology questions at this point.
Okay. All right. So I'm going to keep this moving and leave time for questions at the end as well. So the basics of platform skills. I have six bullet points here. I think I could have fit seven, but I wanted to make this formatting right. They can be divided into prior preparation, posture and movement, breathing, speed and pacing, asking questions and answering questions, and we'll take those in turn. I recognize this sounds a little bit like Jeopardy categories right now. So for prior preparation, you want to know, is there a preferred format? In the case of this talk, there is a preferred format, and I am following it. And I strongly recommend if you can find out if there's a preferred format, do so. It makes your life so much easier because you don't have to figure out how to format things on your own. You can just do whatever the preferred format is. And I would say it's not worth having, any kind of feelings about your formatting preferences. Just follow the prior format. You want to know what is your time frame as well for providing secondary materials. That would be slides, posters, if you need flip charts, who provides those and who needs to find out by when, and get that to people in time. This slide deck, I believe, they have had since at least a few months ago. That's an unusual situation. Normally, it can be anything from a couple weeks to, day before. I strongly, strongly recommend if you have to provide your material to other people, then whatever the earliest date you can provide it to them, make that your deadline. Because it's very, very easy to, get sidetracked by other things. The next point for prior preparation is to decide if you want or need a script. There are some people who swear by a script. They say, if I write a whole script, I know, I can practice it. I know I have exactly this amount of time, and I know that I, say what I'm going to say in this amount of time. What I will say is the danger there is that it becomes very tempting to try and memorize word for word your script, and it can be an enormous time sink. So you have to decide if that's something that's helpful for you to write it all out and then figure out, okay, this is exactly what I want to say. How do I memorize this? Or how do I memorize the key points so I get back to them? Or if you, are an expert in this material, you may find that you just need mnemonics for yourself and you don't need a script. The question then is, do you need to time yourself? How much practice do you need? And these are things that are built into giving a presentation. So it's not just giving the presentation day of. You should know, how long will it take me to say all of this stuff? Have I built in time for questions? Have I built in time for introductions? you know, you want to make sure that you're not going to go way under time, and definitely you don't want to go over time. What I will tell you from years and years of experience is that nobody has ever said, I'm so glad that you chose to talk for another 20 minutes. So, you know, definitely you want to get people on time. And one of the ways that you do that is decide whether or not you need to practice realistically. And if you do, set aside some time to practice your presentation so you know, okay, I can do this in 20 minutes and leave 10 minutes for questions. Then you want to brainstorm possible questions. And the key point here is don't focus only on the smart questions that you want to be asked. You'll probably not be asked those, you know, smart, fun questions that you have the perfect answer for. Instead, what you want to focus on is how might people not get it? And I mentioned this earlier, you know, what are the key points where people can get confused, can go astray? You want to be prepared for that. There will potentially always be that one person who says something completely out of left field. And at that point, you can say, you know, thank you for your question, you know, and then you can either say something like, I think that warrants a fuller response and we can talk about this afterwards. Or sometimes, depending on how, you know, how far afield it was, you can just say thank you for that and move on. But the idea here is that you want to brainstorm and prepare for possible questions. So are there any, well, rather, what questions do you have about prior preparation before we talk about platform skills in person?
So there were questions that they came in earlier. They wanted to know how do people perceive someone that may sound overly rehearsed? So is too much practice a bad thing?
Well, it sounds like there's a clue to the answer they might want when you say overly rehearsed. But that said, there's a balance to strike. I think there is an overlap between the people who find the need to write a very detailed script and practice it a lot of times, and the people who maybe sound a little stiff in giving a presentation and perhaps a little robotic and rehearsed. So it's... You know, I'm not going to tell people not to rehearse because I think that's probably better to do. But, you know, you should be able to go off script a little bit or to flex as, you know, maybe you get an interesting question in the middle of the topic. And if you know the topic inside and out, you should be able to find your way back to your talk. There's a sketch on Saturday Night Live on Weekend Update, which is I don't think they've done it lately, but they had the bar mitzvah boy as a character, and he would come on and would recite, you know, exactly what he was going to say for his portion of the talk, and then Colin Jost or Michael Che would ask him a question, and he would look at them and then go right back to his script. And that's the sort of extreme example there, but the idea here is you want to be able to sort of roll with the punches as people ask you questions, or if anything, you know, goes a little bit differently than you expected. And you should know the material well enough that you can get back to it as need be. So I hope that answers that question. I'm really loving the session because these are all different questions than every previous session. This is fantastic.
Well, we do have other questions about accents and imitations, and if they have a higher pitch, does that make them sound automatically, you know, less confident, which they do. I want to hold some of those until the end.
Yeah, hold on to those. Hold on to those for me.
A question. You had mentioned about making accommodations for those who might be colorblind, and people were wondering if you could provide a resource, because some of the information or guidance they get to is sort of confusing. I know tips that I've been given, but are there places you can point them?
Yeah, I need to look into this a little bit more. So most of my research, most of my, so for my work, I generate most of the images that I'm making. I generate the graphs, I generate the maps, and I do that primarily in R, which is a open source statistical computing package. With R, there is a Viridis color scale. I'm not sure to what extent Viridis is open for everything else, although they do have all of their material online, and I believe they have like the hexadecimal and other, you know, color labels for what they use. So I would recommend that. That's V as in Victor, I as in India, R as in Romeo, I as in India, D as in Delta, I as in India, S as in Sierra Veritas. And that I highly, highly recommend. But again, you know, that's been a very easy solution for me. And as far as, you know, using different platforms, it may be more or less difficult to use it. But there's a variety of different colorblind-friendly palettes to choose from, and it should be relatively easy. Like, I could go to the Veritas website, for instance, and, you know, copy the color for a PowerPoint presentation with the little, you know, the little ink drop tool. So that's one way that you could do things. But yeah, to the extent that you can, I would say beyond that, you know, maybe stay away from a diverging red-blue color scale, right, or a red-green color scale, because those are the two main types of color blindness that people have. Okay, I hope that answers that. And I'm going to keep moving with platform skills and leave more time for these other questions at the end of the presentation. So, platform skills. I have divided this. There's actually seven of these. I have four on this slide, three on the next. So you'll see I'm following my own advice here. Effective speakers will manage nerves, voice, eye contact, body, and then the next slide is going to tell you gestures, language, and transitions and segues. Nerves, the main thing that I have to say about this is that there's a fantastic book called How Emotions Are Made, which talks about the physical connection with the physical body and the mind and emotions. And the main finding is that there's not one physical signature for anger and one physical signature for fear and one physical signature for happiness, but rather there's a lot of the same physiological and physical processes that happen that are implicated in a variety of different feelings. And what this means for us is that when you are nervous, that's going to be elevated heart rate, that's going to be, you know, elevated breathing. These are things that are directly physically related to or even the same as excitement. You know, it's easy for people to say, just transform your nervous energy into excitement. But you can really choose to reset and say, okay, this is, you know, I'm going to recognize that my heart rate's a little higher. I'm going to recognize that I'm breathing a little shallow and a little fast. And you can recognize it for what it is, which is a sign of physical excitement, and then choose how to interpret it. But also just be aware of it. It's normal. It's natural. Everybody has nerves before giving any sort of presentation. And so there's nothing wrong with you if you are nervous before giving a talk. But then you'll want to think about, okay, how can I adapt to this? How can I deal with this? So as I was talking about the research, one of the things that people notice is when you're out of breath. Well, that's a symptom of being nervous. That's also, you know, a symptom of excitement. If you know that you're nervous, you can make a point of building into your presentation a habit of taking deep breaths or slowing down or pausing when you need to. When we're talking about voice, that's volume, pace, and intonation, those I mentioned already. Volume, I think I don't even know if I touched on that earlier, but you want an appropriate volume for people. And these relate, that relates more to pace and intonation as well. If you're yelling, you end up, you know, having a particular sound in your voice that you don't have if you're straining to speak versus if you're speaking calmly and comfortably. A microphone will help with that if it's available, so you can then speak in a more comfortable register. Pace is something I'm sure you've heard me speeding up and slowing down. I mentioned earlier my bad habit is speaking very, very quickly. One of the things that I do is I try and remind myself to think about Maya Angelou, and this is something that one of my mentors told me. They said, just think about how Maya Angelou gives an interview. And for those of you who haven't seen Maya Angelou give an interview, I recommend finding her on YouTube. But she savors every word. She's a poet and an author and a brilliant wordsmith. And you can tell when she's talking that she knows that you're listening, that she's confident that you will continue to listen, and she's savoring every word as she's going through. And then lastly, with intonation, I think I can answer one of those questions from earlier right here, which is you should not be trying to pitch your voice higher or lower than is natural for you. Rather, think about what's comfortable in your vocal register, what feels good in your voice, and stay there. And it's really, you know, just remembering not to, out of excitement or nervousness, diverge from that too much. And the main thing that people do when they're nervous or excited is they pitch their voice up really high. With eye contact, you want to focus on both range and focus. In person, what I'll say is just look out across, you know, you can scan the room. Don't make, you know, fixed eye contact with one person the whole time. That will be alarming for them and confusing for the rest of the audience. And you don't actually have to flit, you know, from eye contact, person to person in the audience. You can sort of just scan the room. With virtual meetings, it's a little bit different. I think we all generally agree, okay, you know, we know you're looking at your computer screen, so, you know, we're not necessarily expecting you to be looking at us. If you really want to focus on connecting with people, then you can focus on looking directly at the computer camera, wherever it is. And that's something that does give the illusion of direct eye contact. But it's not something that I think people are really terribly fixated on. I think people are generally understanding with these virtual meetings. What I will say, though, is that where you position your video is going to have an effect on how you're perceived. So if you're holding, you know, a iPad or other tablet in your lap as you're talking, then people are going to be looking up your nose, and you'll have, you know, double chin and whatever else, as the case may be, depending on where your camera is. So one of the things that I do when I'm using one of these web-based platforms is I'll use my laptop, but I have it on a stack of books. So it's the camera itself is at my eye level. And what that does is makes it so as I'm looking at the screen, I don't look like I'm looking down. And you also don't look like you're looking up at me, and I don't have to, you know, tilt my neck in a way where I start to make my face look weird. Because realistically, we don't talk to people where their face is in the same position as our computers usually are when we're working. So that's something to keep in mind with a virtual setup. And then eye contact is really up to you. But know that if you're making eye contact with somebody on the screen, that will not give the impression of making eye contact with them, because their eyes are really not what you're seeing as their eyes, but their eyes are going to be, you know, where your computer camera is. I say that, but I say take it with a grain of salt, because I don't think people care that much about it, although it's sort of a best practice for you. This is, I think, more relevant if you're making videos for, you know, an interview that you're doing on TV or something, or a YouTube video or something like that. For you know, in-person work meetings remotely, I think people are a little bit more forgiving. Moving on to the body, there's a couple of different things to think about. That's posture, stance, and movement. When you're in person, what I recommend is a good posture. So think Superman, think Clark Kent. And then, you know, whatever your stance is, whatever your movement is, I recommend against hands in pockets. I recommend against, you know, fidgeting with a bunch of stuff. And as you're moving, what I'll say is the main thing that will be distracting for people is either pacing or going back and forth from one foot to another, you know, your weight on one foot and the other, where you end up looking like a very tall metronome. So the recommendations that I would make are, you know, take a power stance. It doesn't have to be that, like, Superman staring out of the distance, hands in the hip kind of thing, although there are studies that suggest that if you do take one of those Superman power stances before you give a talk in the green room or wherever, that it actually has a measurable effect on your confidence and your perceived confidence afterwards as you're giving a talk normally. But, you know, you don't have to do that as you're giving the talk. What I'll say, too, is as you're thinking about your hands, that affects this sort of body movement as well. So I'll move on to hands and gestures in just a second. But the key thing with the body is just stand upright. You can plant your feet. You don't actually have to move anywhere. And in fact, nobody notices if you just stand still with your feet planted. It's the weirdest thing because it feels strange. It feels unusual. But, you know, I've tag-teamed this presentation with a colleague of mine and stood feet planted, hands by my side, for a solid 5 minutes, and nobody noticed, because we asked them afterwards, and they just didn't notice. It just seemed normal. They were focusing on the rest of the presentation. With your hands. Oh, last thing. If it's in person, I would recommend against hiding behind a lectern. It's very easy if you have a lectern to then start to hunch towards the microphone and then start to make yourself smaller and smaller and smaller, because everybody's staring at you, and it gives you sort of physical protection. And I recommend against that. If I can, when I have a lectern, I'll usually walk around and stand either in front of it or beside it, because it gives me something where there's nothing in between me and the audience, which can be a little scary for the presenters, but it also helps create a connection. And then if you have these other tools of, okay, I'm going to stand in this way, I know what to do with my hands, then you don't feel the need for the safety blanket of hiding behind the lectern or hiding, you know, behind the slides. So moved on to the remaining three, that's gestures. For hands, that helps with the body. If you have a handheld microphone, that gives you something to do with one of your hands, and the other hand doesn't actually have to do anything. If it does, what I'll say is with the gestures, they should be meaningful. So I come from a background where a lot of my family members are very, very expressive with their hands. And what I have found is that I personally need to tone that down a little bit. I'm actually waving my hands right now as I'm demonstrating toning something down, but I need to tone that down just a little bit for audiences. What I will say is that you should not feel like you can't use your hands at all, but your gestures should be related to what you're saying and should be generally inclusive and related. So I will say if you don't know what to do with your hands, holding a microphone is fine. Holding a bottle of water is fine, although, you know, I strongly recommend against picking it up, setting it down, taking the cap off, putting the cap back on, setting it down, picking it up again, and never taking a drink, because people start thinking, you know, will he or won't he with taking a drink of water. So a couple of things that you can't go wrong with. One is holding a microphone and letting the other hand hang. If you're gesturing, you can point to the slides or point to the particular thing that you're talking about on the slides, and that's very, very helpful. Another is sort of some people call it an interview posture, but it's like hands in front of you, one hand palm up, the other hand resting on it, palm down. So this is, if any of you have a wrestling background, you can hold like a gable grip in front of you, and it's just a neutral way of holding the hands. Beyond that, I would say don't overthink it, but, you know, if you're starting to wonder, am I gesturing too much? Do I look like I'm flailing? Then you probably are. And one of the easiest things you can do is just put your hands down. Not in the pockets, not behind you, just hands down by the side. And like I said, people really don't notice, even though it feels extremely strange as you're doing it. And that feeling, I will tell you, doesn't really go away if you're somebody who's used to gesturing, but your presentations go fine with your hands by your side. With language, it should be inclusive and technical. What I mean there is if you have to have technical language, which I very often do, the easiest, best practice is to use it and then immediately define it and then use it again. And that means, you know, continue defining as much as necessary. So, for instance, I think I mentioned OSCs earlier, that's on-site coordinators, and I did exactly what I did just now because it's absolutely habit. Which is say the thing, define it, and then continue. And I mentioned OSCs in the context of giving presentations for the EPA. When I worked with OSCs recently, they would use technical jargon that I had no idea what they were talking about. And I think the key point is if you use it, define it. And even if everybody in the room knows what it is, and you'll figure out where the line is, you know, if it's a work meeting and everybody knows all the jargon, then you don't want to slow everybody down by defining everything that they already know. But as soon as you start bringing people outside your own work group into it, I strongly, strongly recommend erring on the side of inclusivity and just defining something over and over again. You know, for instance, I talk about Zulu morphosyntax and some of my research. And when I say morphosyntax, that's what the words are and how the word pieces fit together in a sentence. And, you know, if I'm going to give a talk to the Linguistic Society of America, I'll still say I'm going to talk about, you know, Zulu, which is a Bantu language spoken in South Africa, and I'm going to be focusing on the morphosyntax, which you'll all recall is what the pieces of the words are and how they fit together. And then I'll keep it moving. So I strongly, strongly, strongly recommend thinking about what are all the different points where I might use jargon and just get in the habit of defining everything as you go. It cannot hurt. It can only help. Lastly, transitions and segues are important. I mentioned signposting earlier, and I'm going to say it again here. Every step of the way, you should tell people where you are, where you're going. And one of the ways that you do that is you say, you know, you start with the objectives. You start with how you're going to go through the talk. And then you tell people where you are every step of the way. So I am just wrapping up talking about platform skills. I'm going to solicit questions, and then I'm going to talk about soliciting questions. So actually, that said, maybe I'm going to change this. I'm going to wrap up platform skills, and I will ask you questions about that and soliciting questions because I want to demonstrate soliciting questions here. From here, we're going to go on to, you know, wrapping up participant management and then wrapping up and going to questions. But you'll notice what I'm doing is telling you every step of the way, we are here, we just did this, we're going to do this, here we go. So moving on to soliciting questions, which is the only place here where I don't actually solicit questions for you because I wanted to, like I said, mention what the best practices are here, and then we'll talk about questions you have for both parts of these. First, assume that there will be questions. So don't ask what questions do you have. You'll notice I generally don't ask that. And definitely avoid, do ask what questions do you have and avoid are there any questions. Are there any questions is a yes, no, and the implied correct answer is no. When you ask what questions do you have, that assumes that there are questions, that frees people up to feel comfortable having questions, and it encourages them to ask those questions. If I just assume that you have a question, say what questions do you have, you're much more likely to ask whatever question you have than if I sort of browbeat you with there's no questions, right? So after you ask for questions, stop talking. And I strongly recommend just silently count to 10. Wait several moments for them to think. It's a perfect time to drink, take a sip of water or tea or whatever you have for keeping your vocal cords, you know, smooth and running. And that gives you something to do in that time. Not only are you making yourself a little bit, you know, more comfortable, but you give people the opportunity to ask questions. And not only do you assume those questions, but you really make it clear, I'm doing something else. I'm not talking right now, so you're free to come up with these questions. When you are answering, you'll notice I do a little bit different here than in person, but first you want to let the questioner finish. Two, rephrase the question. There's two reasons for this. One is it makes it clear that you understood the actual question, and sometimes people phrase the questions weirdly, so they ask you a question and you rephrase it and they say, no, that's not what I was trying to say. So you get a better idea of what the actual question was. And two, it makes sure that everybody else can hear it if you're using the microphone. So somebody will ask in the middle of the room some question, you can hear them, but the people in the back can't. So let the questioner finish, rephrase the question, and then respond to everyone, not just the person who asked the question. And this is where a lot of the academics fall down, because somebody will ask a question, and then you see two people having a conversation in a weird format rather than a presenter answering a question to the room. A couple of key points are to refer to the central theme of your speech or your talk or your argument or whatever it is that you're doing. And if you can't tie their question back to it, then that tells you something. So you should be able to tie it directly back or say, I really want to focus on this talk. You can feel free to postpone an answer, which I have done here a couple of times, or throw the question back to the group if it's in person. Oftentimes, somebody might ask a question where somebody else in the audience has the answer or has a better answer than you do, and don't hesitate to let that person answer the question. Lastly, I'll say respect the questioner, and by that I mean, treat what they're saying in the best possible light, even if sometimes the question is not intended in a positive light. So I've seen, you know, some very aggressive academic questioning where it's clear it's just this person doesn't like this other person and they're trying to come up with a gotcha question. And even in that situation, the best practice is to choose to interpret it in the best possible light, choose to assume goodwill on the part of the questioner, and choose to treat them with respect. It can be tense in the room with contentious participants, but it's a best practice, and you will come out of that looking good. Sometimes you can let the audience answer for you. I mentioned that just a second ago. And before we get into participant management, which is sort of building on this, let me stop here and ask, what questions do you have about the previous two sections?
Well, we did have a question about responding to someone that asks multiple run-on questions. So perhaps giving them too much power when you pause for questions. How do you sort of continue?
Yeah, so that's a perfect segue into the next section, but the preview for that is you are in charge, and you can determine what you answer and what you don't answer. So I think a lot of us get into this mindset of, I have been asked a question and I have to answer these questions. And then what happens is somebody gets the mic and they say, well, I have three questions and a comment, and it's too much. So you can choose to say, you can answer one of them and say, I'm going to move on to other questioners, and, we can talk offline afterwards. You can try and give short answers to each of them, or you can just not. I mean, you're in charge. That's the beautiful thing about giving presentations in this way. And I recognize, it depends on what the question is, what the questioner is, what the presentation is. But in general, if you're following these best practices, especially the participant management ones that I'll talk about next, it's a lot easier to just navigate that. You don't have to answer everything. You don't have to answer everything in detail. And you can push it to after the talk as well. Or to the appropriate person who can answer it. You can say, I can't answer that question for you right now, but I know somebody else who can, and I'm going to get this, sorted out and get you an answer next week. What other questions are there before I move into participant management?
So we do have some questions about just their own voice and how to manage their voice and their tone. But the other one that's coming back, and I think we've seen these questions before, is about ums and ahs and how do you get that? Could you eliminate and ah completely? Or if you are trying to eliminate it, how do you actually do that?
Okay. So there's two things, and I just said because I'm lexically primed, meaning I've heard it before and now I'm more likely to say it. But there's two points there. There's a lot of research on this. One stream of the research is on what the social function is, and I think that's important to keep in mind. So when people use or it's something that we use normally in casual conversation, and it indicates that I'm still talking, but I'm thinking. It's completely natural. It's completely normal. Everybody does it. The issue is when you give presentations like this presentation, like, slideshows to the general public or what have you, or an interview on the radio, something like that, it's a different format than a casual conversation with a listener. And the listeners are now audience members rather than participants. And they're unlikely to cut you off. So their expectation is that you don't say or ah, because it's a totally different communicative situation. That said, it's, like I said, completely normal, completely natural, but people will have feelings about it. And any talk that you give, some people, there's going to be somebody there, like, counting. Well, you said, 25 times, and 37 times, and you said right 32 times. So for some people, it becomes a habit that we say it so much, it becomes distracting for people, and it can become a crutch. And there's other things as well. So like is one that people notice, sort of, kind of. These are fillers that are used in normal conversation and serve a particular function, but because the format of a presentation like this is different, people notice them more and have feelings about them. If you are somebody who says it a lot, or you have gotten this feedback and been told that you say or ah too much, it's relatively, it takes a little bit of effort, takes a little bit of time. But one of the things that you can do is just pause there. And you've noticed when I was speaking here, I'm really focusing on it, so I haven't said or ah in the last few minutes anyway, for maybe twice. What I'm doing instead is just pausing and not speaking. And it's something that works for people. It's something that's very effective. you're never going to cut out all the ums and uhs. And so if you start thinking about it, you're going to just start fixating on when you do and when you don't, saying, oh, I said it again. But you can definitely cut down a significant portion of them by just remembering and choosing to be silent for that second. Because you're in charge of the presentation, people will allow you that silence without cutting you off. So hopefully that answers the question. The best tool that I have really is just, you can record yourself if you want to. That's extreme. You can have somebody point out every time you do it, but that will give you, that will grind your gears to a halt as you're trying to give a presentation. Or you can try and listen and monitor your own speech and choose to just say it in your head, but be silent in the world. I hope that helps. It's a huge pet peeve for some people, and it shouldn't be, but it is.
Yeah, and many people have chimed in that this is great. This is exactly what they needed, so they appreciate it.
Okay. And the thing is, if you start doing that, you start thinking about it a lot, and then it gets you sidetracked, and it can grind you, it can really grind you to a halt. So I am aware now, since being asked that question, I said two ums and one uh. And you start getting this running tally of them, and it gets very distracting. So I would say if you're going to practice something like having somebody interrupt you or recording yourself, definitely do it some other time than in the presentation. Then don't be too hard on yourself if a few slip out. So if we're good on that, if there aren't any other questions that are pressing right now, let me get to participant management, and then I'll leave some time for questions at the end and make sure that everybody gets out of here on time or early. That's the Taylor Jones promise. You get out of here on time or early. So for participant management, effective speakers will use participants' names where possible. There are some times where it's not, where nobody has name tags, nobody has name plates, you have too many people in the room. But ideally, you'll use people's names, especially when calling on them. If you are calling on people and you don't have names, I will say do not point at people. If you are going to encourage participation or solicit participation, the way that I usually do that is with an outstretched hand, an open palm, and palm is usually facing up at about 45 degrees. So it's a very welcoming, open gesture. I'm not pointing an index finger at them. I'm definitely not pointing a middle finger at them or anything else. And if you're putting the hand out as an open palm all the way up or all the way down, it's a little weird. So this is very studied, but it comes across as very, very natural and open, and it works. So I'd say if you're going to gesture to people, palm up at about 45 degrees, sort of open, welcoming, like you're, like one half of a hug, you know. So the next one is, I'll say, reinforce desired and appropriate participant behaviors, meaning, you know, give people a cookie for being good, effectively, metaphorically, although I have seen presentations where people do give cookies or gold stars or whatever else for good behavior. Refer to previous contributions made by participants. So that is just a general best practice. If somebody else has already answered something, or you can use something that somebody else already said, then refer to it and refer to them by name if you can. This is higher level stuff, so, and usually for longer presentations. So, you know, if you're giving a 20-minute talk on a remedial site, then maybe you're not going to use all or any of these, but these can be very helpful. With other questions, so you'll respond appropriately to questions. That means don't get heated, don't get hooked, don't get emotional about what somebody asks. Even if somebody asks you a question, it's really more of a statement, and the statement's really more of a criticism. Just let it wash over you and recognize that you are the face of the institution. You are the face of the organization for the duration of the talk. You are not you. You are, you know, NARPM. You are EPA. You are, you know, University of Pennsylvania. You are not you. And you'll manage challenging participant behavior, and we'll get into that in just a second, but you'll make the experience enjoyable for everybody. So for contentious participants, one, attempt to take their question in the best, most charitable light, even if you know it wasn't intended that way. And this is just a general best practice. I find this helps me not just in presentations, but in life. Just assume goodwill from people, even if they're going out of their way to tell you that they're not acting in goodwill. Thank them for their feedback. And usually this is when you get that question that's not a question but a statement. Thank them for their feedback. Always thank them. If they're wrong, One of the best things you can do is thank them for bringing up the topic and allowing you the chance to clarify. And I can't tell you how many times I've won over an audience where somebody has said something where they either misunderstood what I was saying or wanted to portray me as saying something different, had an aggressive, you know, more of a statement than a question that was wrong. And you went over the audience by saying, thank you so much for that. And in fact, that's a very important point that you brought up. And I think I could perhaps explain that better than I did before. And I'm so glad you brought that up for me to circle back to. And then you dive in and you explain. That said, don't get stuck repeating or clarifying. Once you've explained, you can cut it and offer to discuss later. So they say, well, no, you're not understanding my criticism. Really, I'm saying this. And say, let's talk about this afterwards and make sure we get to the bottom of this and leave time for other people's questions as well. So you don't have to, you know, if somebody says X and you say, well, actually, Y, and they say, no, X. You say, well, thank you for that, and we're moving on. You do not have to keep getting into this cycle with people. Lastly, if their comment's not relevant, thank them for participating and just refocus with the option of discussing more after the presentation. And that happens a lot with, you know, well-meaning academics. So they'll say, you know, that reminds me, and just tell you about their research from 20 years ago. You can say, well, thank you for that. Let's talk more offline. And you're good. The key point here, like I said, is you are the face of the institution. You are the face of the organization. You have the power in that situation. And it's an artificial situation in which you are giving a talk to an audience, and the audience wants that to stay that way. They want it to be a talk where they don't have to be in charge of the whole thing. They don't really want to derail it, and even if there is one person who wants to derail it, the rest of the audience doesn't want that to happen. So you're remembering that and coming from a place of goodwill, but also, okay, it's my job to keep this moving, we'll go a long, long way. The last thing I want to do before wrapping up and opening everything up to last questions is talk about the gift of feedback. This is something that's not really here or there in the presentation, but I think it's important just in general, and we always talk about this at CulturePoint. So effective feedback is a gift. It is given to be helpful. If you are giving feedback, it should be specific rather than general. So, you know, I liked this particular thing or I didn't like this particular thing. It should be focused on behavior, not on the person. So I really didn't like how he said 25 times when answering the question about and not that guy's an idiot and I couldn't believe he was so terrible. It should be descriptive rather than evaluative. So again, not that was terrible, but these are the things that happened and here's, you know, what can be improved on and why. It should be concise, well-timed, and checked. And checked means both verified and also tempered in how you give feedback. That kind of feedback, though, is a gift, and it should be actively solicited. We try and tell organizations that this kind of feedback should go horizontally and vertically in both directions. You should be soliciting meaningful feedback and should be giving meaningful feedback. And as you give meaningful feedback, it's that checklist, right? Is this specific? Is this focused on behavior? Is this descriptive? Is this going to help somebody do something better in the future? And in general, when it's framed that way, people also react really, really well to it. And I think it's best to try and think of contentious participant behaviors as well as a kind of feedback where they're just not good at following these guidelines for it. So that should bring us to the wrap-up here, where I'll ask you, you don't have to answer this right now, but the sort of thoughts for later are what have you learned here about presentations, about yourself, and you can think about what you will do differently in the future as you give presentations. We have about 8 minutes. I know some of that is designated for wrap-up, but I want to open this up and answer whatever other questions you have now that we've gotten through the material.
All right. So I'm going to start with some questions that came in earlier. I'm going to group some of them together, but the key...
Real quick, you can't see me, but I'm taking a sip of water. So this is the perfect time. You ask, sip.
So the key concern people are expressing is that something in how they personally express themselves will be problematic. So perhaps are certain accents better received than others? So if they come from the South, is that going to be poorly received? Or if they come from New York, would that be poorly received? And then related to that, what if their pitch is just naturally higher? Does that mean that people won't find them confident? So just concerns about their own natural speech patterns and what they should do.
So I have bad news. a lot of my research in linguistics is on linguistic discrimination, and it is one of the last places that discrimination is not only accepted but often still encouraged. And it manifests itself in a variety of ways. So what I will tell you, first of all, is that everybody here, everybody participating, the people who have those questions, there is nothing wrong with how you speak. It is highly unlikely that there's something wrong with how you speak, because these are not questions about speech pathologies. These are questions about accents and identity. That said, people will judge how you speak. And there's a variety of different things people judge. So women are judged against whether they use creaky voice, and men are not generally. Creaky voice or creaky phonation is when your vocal cords vibrate slowly enough that you can hear the individual flaps. And so that would be, you know, if you want to think about a positive evaluation of creaky voice, think of Mr. Spock or Captain Picard on Star Trek. Captain Picard is, like, just the creakiest of people, but everybody thinks it indicates, you know, competence and knowledge and wisdom when it comes from an older white guy. Whereas women are generally interpreted very differently for when they use creaky voice. The same thing goes for regional and local accents. So Southern accents are stereotyped in some ways. And what I'll say is all of these, there's two components. There's negative stereotypes and there's positive stereotypes, where linguists will refer to it as covert prestige. So, you know, a Southern accent, people may think that you are less competent and less intelligent upon first meeting, but you can build on that, very quickly disabuse people of those wrong notions. And at the same time, there's the covert prestige element of being immediately perceived as being down to earth. Same thing goes for, you know, New York accents. The idea is people will say, oh, that's, you know, they're, I was trying to find I very nearly used some inappropriate language here. So they're hard, but potentially no nonsense, right? So there's two sides to the coin for each of these. What I will say is, if you are consistently getting feedback that the way you speak is distracting to people, then it may be worth thinking about what feedback you're getting and what you can do or should do to change that, but also taking it with a grain of salt. So if you're told that you just speak too high, well, if that's where your voice is pitched naturally, then that's where your voice is pitched naturally. If you are from, you know, Louisville, Kentucky, and you have a Louisville accent, then people are going to have to deal with that. And you will absolutely get feedback on that, both effective feedback and just criticism that is effectively, you know, linguistic discrimination, for the foreseeable future. It's something that is a key area of my research interest, and there's not a lot of hope for research coming out about people, you know, changing their perceptions of dialect or of accent, of, you know, pitch and you know, gendered approaches to language. So it's worth being aware of, but at a certain point I'd say, you know, there are certain things you can do that you can choose to do and say, this is in the interest of accommodating some general notion of professionalism. And you will have to decide for yourself what the line is where you say, you know, I have made a movement towards accommodating professionalism, and the feedback that I'm getting now is just linguistically biased. Now, really quickly, the last thing that I'll say on this is you have gotten a linguist here, so I'm going to say everything that you guys say is right. It is how your speech community speaks. It is normal. It is natural, and I can back that up scientifically. But you have to balance that with you're going to be giving presentations to the general public, and they aren't a room full of linguists who would agree. You know, you may think about how do I eliminate ums and uhs? Am I speaking really high in my register? Am I using my telephone voice? And is that something that I'm doing? So, you know, what are ways that you can flex towards the sort of constructed idea of professionalism? But always keeping in mind that as a professional linguist who works on accents, I will tell you, you're not wrong.
Okay. All right. We did have some questions about humor. So some of the attendees were wondering how appropriate it might be to weave humor into your presentation style.
This is directly related to the last question, in that different people will be perceived differently. So I do a lot of work around diversity and inclusion. I am a white guy. I do work with a couple of other facilitators. One is a black man, one is a white woman, and these are relevant in that the jokes that work for the black man and the white woman don't work for me at all, and vice versa. We all have our own points. I would say use humor very sparingly. People should recognize that in general, there's a fair amount of research that suggests that women are negatively evaluated for using humor, especially self-deprecating humor, and that men in general can get away with a little bit more self-deprecating humor, and self-deprecating humor is going to be better received than, knock-knock jokes that don't seem relevant to the subject at hand. You'll notice that I told one joke, which was kind of a cliche joke, and it's not, I'm not writing stand-up comedy for you. And it was by way of illustrating something in the talk. And so I would say use it very sparingly, use it very judiciously, and be aware of how the joke will land with whatever your audience is and also coming from you. You have to be aware of who you are and how you're perceived. And if you aren't confident in all of those components of it, then maybe don't include a joke.
Okay. I think we'll go ahead and close out our question period now. But Taylor, any final thoughts you want to leave the audience with before I provide those last reminders?
I just want to thank you all for your time, and I hope that this was useful to you. And one of the things that I'll say is I really appreciated all the questions about technology, I hope that you all have the opportunity to use the in-person stuff as well, sooner rather than later. And I hope everybody's surviving social isolation well. So I wish you all the best.
Likewise, thank you. And Taylor, I've gotten lots of comments and input from the audience. They appreciated it. They've already picked up some things that they're going to start implementing. Still other questions, so I'll be sure to share these with you, but I want to thank everyone who took time to share their thoughts and their questions today. With that, I'll go ahead and transition over to our closing reminders before we let everyone go. Just wanted to let everybody know that this session is part of an ongoing series that we host on the Cleanup Information Network, so I encourage you to visit us at cluin.org or to sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, to learn about new online training opportunities. For those of you looking for copies of the presentation materials, we already have those posted. I've shared a link to get to that page right in the Q&A. You'll also be able to access it from the same page that you used when checking in today. And then we also have information about our speakers as well as my contact information, so please feel free to reach out if you have follow-on questions. I will ask each of you to take a moment to fill out our online feedback form to let us know what you thought of today's delivery, including not only the material it was covered, but the way that it was delivered. I often get requests for CEUs or PDHs. While we don't issue those, we will provide you with a participation certificate after you fill out the feedback form. Please be sure you check the box at the bottom of the form certifying you were here for the whole session. And then once you submit the feedback form, you can either print out or save a copy of that certificate for your own records. Oftentimes that, along with your registration materials or a copy of the slides, are enough to document your attendance to get credit with your own institution. And yes, this session was recorded, so you'll automatically get an email as soon as the archive is available for on-demand playback. And so with that, I want to thank the over 200 individuals who joined us for today's live broadcast, as well as Taylor for coming back to share his expertise. With that, we'll go ahead and formally conclude today's live broadcast. Thank you so very much.